Thank you. All right, so this is week four. Welcome. Before we start, so this topic that we're doing now, we're taking every week something that everyone knows about, but maybe not the depth of it, and exploring it, and then learning the lessons from it. We're going to continue doing that for a few weeks, but for the rest of the term, especially as we get closer to Yom Tov, we'll do some things to do with Yom Tov as well. So it's all very exciting. But next week, we're going to take a little break from the topic, and we're going to have a special session. It's on the back of your handouts. I'm going to do something with Rabbi Benji and Renana Levy. Oh, thank you. special picture I reserve for these occasions, you see. But that's not the topic. The topic is about mental health. Exploring well-being and mental health from a Jewish perspective. Ranana started an organization called Keshev in Israel, and so it will be a little bit of a panel. It'll be a very nice and enjoyable session, I hope. So please come along and spread the word. So same time, next Thursday, yeah. Just instead of our normal topic, but just the same time, so brought to you, ready to make. Okay, so let's just start with a little bit of a review. So last week we talked about salt and where salt comes up in Judaism. Talked about the idea of, we revisited the idea of chesed and gevura. Talked about good chesed, good gevura, bad gevura. But we talked about the concept that the one that's really dangerous on its own, if it doesn't integrate with the other, is gevura. Gevura is strength, could be good, but very often turns out bad, especially when it's not based on and inspired by the concept of chesed, of kindness and connection and so on. So therefore the idea is that it's like salt, that idea of dipping something into salt, like the challah in salt, where salt is on its own. Good salt and bad salt. So on its own, salt is not a good thing, it's not edible, too much can be very bad for you. But when you mix it with the bread, which is the symbol of chesed and other things, it enhances the taste and it brings out, and it's a great combination. And we brought it out in a similar way to the idea of relationships, where you need chesed and gevura, and when the gevura is there, the loyalty, the consistency, the permanency, the respect and so on, then it makes the love all that much greater and becomes a great relationship. It's true to our relationship with other people, true with our relationship with God, and so on and so forth. So that was the last week concept. Now, today, we're going to talk about the red string. Anyone knows about the red string? Sorry. Yeah, Madonna picked up on it, that's true. She didn't discover it, but as you'll soon see. She just made money off it, actually. It's like a string, I think, that probably cost 5 cents to produce, which she sold for $15 or something. But the red string. So what do you know about the red string? Let's first explore what people already know.
Wards of evil.
Wards of evil, okay.
From Rachel's tomb.
It's connected to Rachel's tomb, we'll see later. Yeah, in fact, quite a fascinating thing. It's connected to Rachel's tomb, as we'll see. Yeah, it is. The Ayin Hara, got to do with the concept of Ayin Hara, correct. Sorry? A Reuter Bendel, yeah, in Yiddish. Called a Reuter Bendel. So, the Reuter Bendel is called the red string, basically, the red thread, yeah. So, the red string is actually a subject of a bit of controversy in Judaism, which we'll explore a bit later. It's interesting. But in the context also, because generally in Judaism, we're actually very afraid of superstition. The reason is because superstition in the Torah is prohibited. General superstition. So when people make up superstitious things, for example, that Friday the 13th is a bad day, that's actually prohibited in Judaism to believe that. Or, if I walk under a ladder, something, I don't know, is going to happen to me, that's nonsense, and that we're actually not supposed to believe in that. Unless the ladder has something wrong with it, then it's a good idea to stay away, otherwise it might fall. But just as a superstition, it's a problem. So there is a concept in the Torah. The Torah warns us not to be superstitious. In fact, in the Torah, it's in the context of the prohibition against witchcraft. It's about the prohibition against any form of pagan worship, because that was also connected to pagan worship. So it's always be very scared of new things. Unless it's something which has its roots, has its origins in Jewish teachings, based on the tradition that we have from generation to generation. So there are those things that the Torah or the Talmud, based on the Torah, so to speak, tells us that we need to be careful of, and that's different, right? So, for example, there are certain things that people try and do on a Tuesday. Because in Judaism, Tuesday is a good day. Why is it a good day? Because when the world was created, God said the word ki tov, it was good twice on a Tuesday. Every day once, Monday nothing, and then twice on Tuesday, right? So that kind of thing. So it'd be interesting to explore now, as some of you said already, the red string concept is not a concept on its own, it's not an independent concept. It comes from the idea of the Ayin Hara, the evil eye. So I want to share with you a general concept to do with that, to understand that in a general sense, and with it explore the concept of the red string, but also learn some very important lessons in this whole discussion. All right, so it's following the same format we're doing the last few weeks. So the concept of the evil eye. What is the concept of the evil eye? First of all, does it exist in Judaism? Is that concept true? The answer is, it is true. We'll talk about later how much we have to be worried about it, but it is true. The idea of the evil eye exists. What is it actually? Now, it means that it is possible for someone to give someone else what we call in Yiddish an ayin hara, an ayin hara, an evil eye. In other words, it is possible to be affected negatively by an evil eye that someone else has generated. That possibility exists. Now, we can protect ourselves from it, and there's all kinds of lessons we can learn from it. The idea, in fact, but the idea is true, right? I'll just share with you a couple of sources. For example, in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of the fathers, there's a saying from Rabbi Yoshua, the great Tanaic sage Rabbi Yoshua, who said that there are three things that can destroy a person, three things that are very destructive. Ayin hara is one of them, the evil eye, the yetzer hara, the evil inclination, which drives us to temptation or do the wrong thing, and sinat habriyot, which is hatred between people. He says those three things are very, very bad for a person. The Tzar, interestingly enough, the Tzar is particularly careful about the concept of ayin hara and says we need to stay away from it and be very careful with it, and so on and so forth, right? So the idea certainly exists. Not only does it exist, but in fact it does have ramifications. We'll soon see. It has ramifications in certain Jewish practices, certain halachot, certain laws. Laws to do with the shul, laws to do with other things that actually are implemented, and the reason behind those laws is protection from ayin hara. Right? But to understand it, we need to understand the whole concept, because the concept of ayin hara, of evil eye, is connected with, it goes together with the idea of highlighting or publicizing something that arouses jealousy, right? It's got to do with the fact when someone's success or someone's blessing is very, very highlighted and very public, and it has the effect of causing other people to be jealous, perhaps. That is a way that ayin hara could be generated, right? Which is also connected to the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, where the tenth one of the Ten Commandments is Lo Tachmod, you shouldn't covet. The idea of jealousy comes into this whole idea. Before I explain it, let me just say this, that just like it is important to protect oneself from ayin hara, it is also prohibited, so to speak. It is. One has to be careful not to cause ayin hara to someone else. So just like one would do things to protect oneself from ayin hara, one should also act in a way that doesn't cause someone else to have an ayin hara. For example, there's a halacha in the Talmud where it talks about a lot of the laws in the Talmud have to do with farming and agriculture, because that was the prevalent sort of culture amongst Jews then. Everyone had farms, and that's where they sustain themselves. And it says that when a person has a neighbor, the neighbor has a field. I mean, one can translate into modern context as well, but I'll just tell you the sort of the original terminology, and that is when someone has a field, and the field is planted and produce is growing, one shouldn't stand at the border of that field and look. Right? Well, it doesn't sound that Jewish, does it? I don't know, we all like yentas and like we like to know what's going on with other people, right? But actually, that's not such a Jewish thing, really. We're very tempted to do that. but because it's none of our business. And if it is our business, then what happens is we stand there, we see it growing. Oh, this guy's doing well this year. You know what? How come last Shabbos and Shul, he only gave $18 for, you know, that kind of thing? And then we start to think about it and become a bit jealous. Obviously, that criticism, that skepticism emanates from jealousy, and we could cause that person an ayin hara, and that's prohibited. So we have to be careful to protect not only ourselves, but to protect others as well. Right? Now, what is the ayin hara? Because the terminology is evil eye, right? So many interpretations understand it, not that the eye itself generates anything evil, that the eye is just a physical organ that we use to see, right? That has the ability to see things. But it's called the ayin hara because what happens is it comes from seeing. It comes from seeing other people. What happens is when we have that jealousy, we have that envy, right? We generate a spiritual negative energy. And that spiritual negative energy can in fact be harmful. Why could it be harmful? How does it work? So the commentaries, the Kabbalists explain it in the following way. God is we say in our tefillah, God is a compassionate God. And sometimes, on the one hand, on the other hand, we have this concept in Judaism called justice, din, or schar v'onesh, reward and punishment, right? Which we talk about in the 13 principles of faith, in the Song of Yigdal, it's mentioned. There is that idea. Not that we should always do good, motivated by reward, or stay away from bad, motivated by the possibility of consequence or punishment. We should do good because it's the right thing to do. But nevertheless, the idea exists, right? Now, very often what happens is that God is what we call noseh avon. He tolerates our weaknesses. Okay, so you didn't do the right thing, give you a second chance, a third chance, a hundredth chance, not a problem, right? However, there is this idea that the Talmud talks about it and the Kabbalists talk about it. Is the idea that sometimes when someone or something becomes highlighted, we cause that person or that environment to go under scrutiny. And when we call it to go under scrutiny, it reactivates the quality of din, of justice from God. And he looks at it closely, and that could put a person in a vulnerable situation. That's what the Kabbalah explains. The energy of din. If someone is just going about doing their own business, no one's perfect, God says, okay, no problem, you know, let him do, right? Suddenly, if I'm very jealous of that person, that becomes like a whole discussion. And I'm jealous, so why does that person deserve to have that? And how come they have it, and I don't have it, and so on and so forth. So what that does is that arouses, we are taught, a sense of scrutiny on that person and on myself. So the commentaries explain that ayin hara is not only bad for the person who we cause an ayin hara to, it's bad for ourselves too. Because we put up both ourselves in scrutiny. I'll tell you a little thing that I once heard from my grandfather. Just to explain it a bit. So there's a story in the Tanakh about there was a prophet in Tanakh called Elisha. He was a disciple of Elijah the prophet. And this Elijah would travel from place to place. And there was a certain town that he would come to. There was a certain woman there called the Isha Shunamit. They would always put him up. In fact, she built for him a certain room and a table and a chair. She wanted to be hospitable to the prophet. And it was a big mitzvah, a big zechut, and so on. This prophet had an attendant that used to go with him called Gehazi. And one day, he was there in that town and he was staying in this woman's lodgings that she had done for him. And Elisha says to Gehazi, could you call the Isha Shunamit? Call her because I want to talk to her because, you know, she's been so unbelievable to us. We need to give her a present. We need to sort of show gratitude. So Gehazi says to Elisha, you know, one of the things woman doesn't have, she doesn't have children. She's infertile. So he calls her, and she says she doesn't have children. So Elisha says to him, is there anything I can do for you? Number one. And he says, can I talk to the king for you? In other words, can I put in a good word to the king? Because there were kings in those days. So she answers a very strange answer. She says, no, thank you, but betoch ami anochi yoshevet. I sit among my nation. That's what she says. So what was the dialogue? So the commentators explain the following. What happened was, this was actually Rosh Hashanah. Elisha was a prophet. He had an in with God, right? He had a direct line, so to speak. So he said to her, do you want me to maybe put in a special mention to the king? King meaning God, right? To which she answers, she says, no, please don't do that. Betoch ami anochi yoshevet. I just want to go with everyone else. I just want to be with everyone else. Be united with everyone else. Be humbled, be understated. I don't want you to mention me to God in a specific, very special way, because that will arouse scrutiny. God says, who are you mentioning? Let me see. Let's examine this. What kind of year she really deserves, right? I'd rather pray with everyone, be with everyone, connect to everyone, and be part of the collective blessing, where I'm not under such spiritual scrutiny, right? So this is an idea. Incidentally, he told me this is just nothing to do with the talk, but just interesting. He told me this thought once, he told me a few times, but he told me this thought, and he said that when he heard this idea, it answered for him a question. What was the question? The question was, a very interesting question. My grandfather learned in a very famous yeshiva in Lithuania called the Mirror Yeshiva. Now they have a big yeshiva in Israel, but it's called the Mirror Yeshiva. And it was a very organized yeshiva, and everything was very structured and organized. And my grandfather lost his mother when he was very young, but he couldn't get, and he had yahrzeit for her on the first day of Sukkot. And normally it's a custom, when you have a yahrzeit, you get an aliyah to the Torah, you get called up to the Torah. He couldn't get one because the custom was that on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which came just before Sukkot, the Rosh Hashivas, the rabbis of the yeshiva, never got called up, which is counter what most shuls do. They normally yes call, but none of the rabbis wanted to get called up. That was the custom in that yeshiva. So they all used to get called up on the first day of Sukkot. So you can get called up. So they used to give him the one of wrapping the Torah. That was his cover. That's what he told me. He never understood why the Rosh Hashiva didn't want to be called up on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Until he heard this idea about the woman in Shaddam, and he said, then he understood because, you know, the great Rosh Hashivas, the great leaders of the yeshivas, when you call them up to the Torah, they would call up with special titles and that, and they didn't want to be singled out on Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah Kippur was the day of judgment. They didn't want to be, you know, they have to call them Harav, Adon, you know, the teacher, the master. They just want to pray with everyone else. So they got called up on Sukkot instead. Anyway, it's interesting. So it's very much the similar idea to Ayin Hara. We don't highlight things, right? We don't flaunt things, we don't highlight things, and when we do it to ourselves or to other people, we arouse the energy of judgment and arouse that spiritual scrutiny, which could possibly be dangerous.
Is that scrutiny from Hashem as well, or just from?
Yeah, because that arouses that concept of highlighting, so then that midat hadin, so to speak, the energy of judgment which comes from God becomes activated, right? Now, we find this concept, as I said, first of all, the Talmud tells us. We find this idea of in Judaism, which we'll talk about a bit later, which is so counter to modern culture, but we find that in Judaism, this concept of privacy and refinement is a very big value. And the Talmud, in fact, says, "Ein habracha shereh," that blessing does not rest only on something which is hidden from the eye. The more hidden something is, the more blessed it is, right? We find this actually historically. You know, we have two tablets, right? God gave the first time the Ten Commandments, which were broken, eventually, right, for the golden calf and everything. And then later, he gave us a second set of Ten Commandments, which is still around. We don't know where it is now. It's hidden together with the ark, but it's eternal. And the Talmud makes a very interesting comment. The Talmud says, Luchot Rishonot, the first pair of tablets, were given with tremendous fanfare, tremendous publicity. The event of Mount Sinai was huge. There was thunder, lightning. It was unbelievable, right? And it didn't last. The second tablets were given quietly. Moses came down the mountain. Here it is, and finished. No big spiel. And they lost. That's the same idea. So as I said before, this actually has this concept of not creating unnecessary exposure, not highlighting things, not arousing jealousy, in fact, translates into actual halachot, actual laws. For example, we have a prohibition against counting people. You know, in Judaism, you're not supposed to count people. You have to make always a change. You don't say, you like say, not one, not two, not three, or use a pasuk. You don't say one, two, three. You don't count, point to people and count them. Again, because that scrutinizes, it highlights individuals, and that's not, it's susceptible, we are taught, to the concept of Ayin Hara. There's a fascinating law in the Torah reading, every Shabbat we call up seven people, right? This becomes an issue where we have like a simcha. You're not supposed to call up two brothers one after another, or a father and a son one after another, because it arouses jealousy among the congregation. Oh, everything's going to this family, you know? The Goldberg family is getting all aliyot this week, so not a good thing, right? We don't do that. Many people have the custom that when a woman becomes pregnant, she does not reveal the pregnancy until it's obvious. Right? Because same thing. At the beginning, vulnerable time, sensitive time. You don't say only to very close family. It's kept very private. We have that custom. No one knows about it until about the fifth month. Same idea. There are many people, this is a custom, it's not a law, but it's a custom many people have. You ask them how many grandchildren have, they won't tell you. I just say I've lost count, which is true, actually. My kids wouldn't be very happy with that, but... Right? But some people don't like to do that. So, you know, if they do, they say, Bli Ayin Hara, whatever the case is, right? All these things, there are things, there are halachot and customs, real legitimate customs, which are designed not to arouse the concept of ayin hara. I'm bringing you all of this just to show you that in Judaism, the concept is true. The concept is a true concept. Now we'll see how much we have to be worried about it, but it does exist. So we find, because this idea does exist, we also find antidotes, we find protections for ayin hara. Things that people do, like the red string, which we'll talk about soon, people do in order to protect oneself from that negative energy. I'm going to share with you those, but what I'm going to do is the following. These protections for ayin hara divide themselves, I think, into two groups. The ones that everyone likes to do because they're easy, and then the ones that are much deeper and better, but they're hard work. Okay. So let's go to the easy ones first.
Baba, do you need to change your screen?
Probably. Thank you.
Baba, can I just ask you a question? So you're talking now about ayin hara, like with jealousy and that kind of jealousy. What if it's... So the concept is, so marat ayin is obviously the same.
Marat ayin
is something else.
Marat about doing something that looks wrong, but it's not. Yes, that's what I'm saying. We'll get to the chams in a second. Okay, so there are things that the Talmud talks about that people would do. There's some like really weird things which are not practiced today. Like the Talmud says, if you go into a city and you're worried about ayin hara, you should put each thumb into the other hand or something. I'm not sure how it was done. I'm not exactly sure. I'm not even sure why that is. I'm just mentioning it because it's in the Talmud. There's a tradition people would hang up things in the shape of fish. They say that fish are protected from ayin hara because fish always have an open eye, and that's a symbol of them. That's why in Rosh Hashanah, one of the reasons we eat fish is for that reason. Right? We eat fish because it's like a protection against ayin hara. I mentioned last week a tradition that some people have to use salt because salt is a protection. Since salt preserves and salt is permanent, that's a protection. My mother was very into this. Or is very into this, I should say. And then there's the chamsa. Chamsa is an interesting one, right? This is more of a Sephardi one, but it's this thing in the shape of five fingers. So that's a very, very controversial one, because not actually sure where it comes from. Because some people say it has origin in Arab traditions, Muslim traditions, Islam. Some people say it has origins in Christian traditions. It's not quite sure exactly if it's a good thing or not thing, but I will note that the Ben Ish Chai, was Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, who was a very, very, an amazingly accepted Jewish leader. He passed away in 1902, when at the height of the community of Baghdad, when there's a very, very, very strong and big community. He says, and I'm not sure why this is, but he says that Kabbalistically, the number five is a good number against Ayin Hara. And he says there was a custom for some people to say Khamsa. Khamsa is five in Arabic. Or Hamsa, I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce it, but it's the number five in Arabic. And he says that's why some people have the letter Hey and some people use a Khamsa, which is that symbol of five fingers. So he seems to support it, which is interesting, and he's definitely a legitimate authority. If I would never tell someone they're not allowed to have a Khamsa, because there are opinions like the Ben Ish Chai, which are amazing, and obviously he thought it was okay. Then we come to the red string. So the red string is a very controversial one. Although legitimate, as we'll see. So there is a passage in writings called the Tosefta. The Tosefta is not the Talmud itself, but it's like literature written by the same rabbis of the Talmud, which were added on later, collected and just added on. It's always printed at the back of each volume of the Talmud. You have these passages which are called Tosefta. Tosefta, the word means addition. The Tosefta brings the custom of the red string and said it's prohibited. Why? Because there's a concept in halacha, a concept of Jewish law, that we're not supposed to engage in practices which the Talmud refers to as Darkei Emori, the Emorite practices, meaning connected to pagan worship. The Tosefta maintains that this was the custom of the old Emorites, it was the custom of pagan worshippers, and therefore it's something we're not allowed to do. That's what the Tosefta says, which sort of, you know, throws it off kind of thing, right? I don't even Donna quite knew the Tosefta. She wasn't quite well versed there. But interestingly enough, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is 16th century halachist who lived in Tzfat, who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, he actually wrote what we know today as the Code of Jewish Law, the Sephardic part of it at least anyways. In his commentary, he has the Shulchan Aruch and he has a commentary. In his commentary, he says, no, the red string is legitimate and we are not obligated to follow what the Tosefta says, and he says because if this reluctance to engage in something which might be considered Darkei Emori, the Emorite practices, is only if it's mentioned in the Talmud itself. So if the Talmud itself felt it was an Emorite practice, they would have mentioned it. Since we only find it in the Tosefta, it's not halakha, it's not binding, and if one wants to, one could use that practice of the red string. That's early sources. What's fascinating is that there was a rabbi called Rav Chaim Elazar Shapira of Munkach, the Munkach Rebbe, very early 20th century Hungary. He explained that it's a good thing. He says that it's okay to use. And he, Kabbalistically, as the Rabbeinu Bachaya, who was a 13th century Spain, talks about also, he talks about the color red. The color red is normally connected with Gevurah, but it's kind of a, going back to last week, but it's kind of a good Gevurah thing, and it's an antidote to bad Gevurah. And Rabbeinu Bachaya says that, you know, that the stone in the breastplate of the high priest had different color stones. The stone of Reuven was red, and that was to be a protection against miscarriage, against other things. And he says the same thing, the Munkach Rebbe, and he says that's why we have this concept of red string. It's the color red, which is an antidote to the idea of bad Gevurah, and he says it is a protection. There's a very fascinating letter. I'll just read it to you, it's quite beautiful. There was in Poland, there was a very big Hasidic Rebbe called the Alexander Rebbe. His name was Rabbi Avram Chaim. His name wasn't Rabbi Chaim. He was Alexander Rebbe's son. His name was Rabbi Avram Chaim. And he writes a letter to a very big rabbi in Jerusalem called Rabbi Shayahu Asher Zelig Margolis. And he writes the following. He said, it has been 12 years, talking about his wife, it has been 12 years since the wedding and she has not yet become pregnant. But now, thank God, she is. Please pray, he was writing to this great tzaddik in Jerusalem, please pray for mercy for her at the holy sites, that she should reach full term easily without any complications, God forbid, and that she should give birth to a living and healthy child. Now, he says, if I may request a favor, being that we know from our holy uncle, the Rebbe Yismach Yisrael, different Hasidic Rebbe, of blessed memory, that for such protection, what it is supposed to do is to take a string, a red string presumably, and measure the string around the tomb of Mother Rachel, Kever Rachel, right? Peace be upon her. I request that you go there, measure out the tomb with the string, and send me the strings for protection that she should complete her pregnancy. Very fascinating. So according to some, and you mentioned this before, the red string is not just about a red string, it's actually about a red string that has been put around Kever Rachel, the tomb of Rachel. Because as we know, the tomb of Rachel Imenu is considered the mother of the Jewish people, that cries for the Jewish people, that begs for mercy for the Jewish people. We just had Tisha B'Av when the temple was destroyed. Our sages tell us, the Midrash says that God didn't want to hear anything from not Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. They all went to God and said, what are you doing? Only when Rachel came, he said, yes, it's going to be destroyed, but don't worry, there'll be hope, it'll be rebuilt. And she's the one that sort of carries the hope for the Jewish people. She cries for the Jewish people. And so on and so forth. And therefore, some say the custom of the red string is an legitimate custom, but it's actually the string, it's not just any red string, it's a red string which has been placed around the Kever Rachel. And others write those. Okay. So that's one part. However, these things are nice, but it's always the easy option, you know. Put up a chamsa, wear a string. Again, these are legitimate things. If one wants to do it, that's great. That's fine. However, there are a lot deeper things, and I think this goes to the crux of the whole story. Right? A lot deeper things that we need to engage in and really understand what is it that keeps the Ayin Hara away. Because once we understand, as we did before, a little bit where Ayin Hara comes from, we can also understand what we do to ward off the Ayin Hara. Before I do that, I'll just tell you a cute little story. There were people that were known to have, like if someone had an experience where everything was going wrong, and they were afraid they were being affected by Ayin Hara, there were people in different shtetlach who, I don't know, they became known to have sort of the power to say some prayers, and they used to call it Yiddish opsprechen the Ayin Hara, like to be able to knock off the Ayin Hara and take it away. My great-grandfather, the one I'm named after, apparently was one of these people in the shtetl where they were. So the story in the family goes that one time, there was a guy in it's called Dokshitzi, the shtetl, that one time he... there was someone in the shtetl who had his parnasa from a horse, some cart, whatever, and his horse died. And he was really, really upset, and he thought that maybe he's being affected by Ayin Hara, right? You know, generally that over the centuries, the people lived in small towns were much more worried about the Ayin Hara than people. It's just the way it was. I don't but anyway, so he thought he'd been affected by Ayin Hara, so he decided he has to go to my great-grandfather and ask him to opsprech the Ayin Hara. But he was a simple guy, so I don't know why he did this, but he knocked on my great-grandfather's window at 3 o'clock in the morning. And he wasn't that impressed, apparently. That's where the story goes. So he tells him, "God, it's my horse, Ayin Hara, please, can you help me? You've got to sprech up Ayin Hara." So he was, apparently the story goes, he was very annoyed that he was walking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So he told the guy, "I'm really sorry, I can't do it because I don't know the horse's mother's name."
Oh, yeah.
Maybe later he did do it for him. Maybe, but it was just, that's the way it goes. Okay. But as I said, we really need to look at what's the essence of what's going on here. And, you know, this is an issue generally, right? We have, and I want to just explain a little because it's a fundamental Jewish idea. In Jewish practice, we have something called sgulot. Sgulot means that if you do something, it's a good omen, right? It's a good omen. Like I said before, like Tuesday is a good day to do things and things like that. But we also forget, there's a joke I once heard, that there's a book, I have this book actually at home, it's called Sefer Sgulot. It's all the things that are taken from different sources about it, that if you do them, if you do this, if you go 40 days to the Kotel or something, all these different things, which are legitimate, some of them, they have sources, some of them are nonsense, but some of them are legitimate things. Some of them are made up just for convenience. Like, you know, there's one that have you heard this one? Like at a chuppah, so many brides have the custom not to go to the chuppah with jewelry. Take off the jewelry for the chuppah, right? So what does it do? They give it to their friends to hold. So it became this thing. Oh, also there's another thing, like, you know, they have to drink up the wine. Because the chassan can't take a sip and they give people to drink up wine. So there's this thing goes around that, like, the girls, if they hold the jewelry of the color, it's a zgula to find a quick match, to find a shidduch. Or the boys, if they drink the wine under the chuppah, they also find it's nonsense. It doesn't say anywhere, it doesn't come from anywhere, it's all nonsense. I have a theory of where it came from. They have to get the wine drunk up, so they figured out, how are you going to incentivize people to drink a whole cup of wine suddenly? You make up a skula. The same thing, who wants to hang on to someone's jewelry for a whole chuppah? It's the main thing, if you hold up the jewelry, it's a skula for a shidduch. Okay, so that's where it comes. So those are nonsense ones, but there are ones that are true. However, I once heard a little joke, they said there's a book of all these legitimate skulot. They said, you know what, it would be a good idea if we put the Ten Commandments into the Book of the Zgulas, because if you put it in the Book of the Zgulas, people will start keeping them, yeah. Right? Like, people are very drawn to, like, these extra little things. If you go to this grave and you dive in there, you know, they're all good things. I'm not knocking them at all. But the best Zgula, if you want to know a real Zgula, is to follow the ways of the Torah. That's what God tells us, right? And not only the ways, but the mitzvot and the values, right? Why am I saying that? Because the real best protection against Ayin Hara is to do two things, really, and a couple other things, but it's much harder work. One is to live with that value of modesty, that value of privacy. And it's so hard. Why is it so hard? Because it's exactly the opposite of what the whole world is about, right? Mm-hmm. Is to be a refined person, not to be happy with what we have and to pray to God to give us good things, but not to... Why do people do that? Because we live in a world today that is so shallow that, as we've spoken about many, many times, it's a world where people live inside out, outside in and not inside out. Right? When our benchmark for success, where our symbol of having made it, is when everyone else knows how successful we are, that's a problem. The Torah value, the Jewish value, is the exact opposite. Jewish value is to live from inside out. Not everyone has to know. We don't have to, as the Yiddish expression goes, we don't have to shtech everyone far de eugen, which means if we're able to do something good, we're able to achieve something. Sometimes it's good to share because you share with good people, close people, good news and things like that. But we need to be sensitive with who we share things with. And we need to be careful of not arousing jealousy. And there's that concept of, I don't need everyone to know. It's a concept of being very happy, showing gratitude, not taking our blessings for granted, knowing that they come from God, and knowing that God has blessed us. And that's our thing. And everyone has their blessings and their things that they have to work on. And that's the way to live. That's a hard thing. It's the concept of tzniut. People say the word modesty is, you know, people always think of clothing, but it's not clothing. It's modesty is a, I mean, it includes the naps, but it's a way of life. It's a way of life of being refined and being not out there, not being the center of everyone's attention. That is a value, a real Jewish value that perhaps is much deeper and a much greater sekula, much greater protection against the concept of Ayin Hara, as it says in many, many, many sources, right? Today, I mean, especially with social media, like, it's amazing how you need to know if someone's successfully cooked a meal of sardines or something, you need to know about it. I'm not quite sure. I mean, either, you know, you can I mean, I don't mind people who might write recipes books, but it's like not necessary to know. Yeah.
You said modesty and privacy. Are they the same thing?
In a way, we respect people's privacy. I'm not saying everyone, obviously everyone has different personalities. Not everyone has to be the most private person, right? And everyone can be the most private person. But there's an idea of saying less.
Yeah.
Being private, being modest, being humble.
I'm just wondering if you can be modest and not private.
You could. I mean, when I say private, I mean it's more of a way of life. Private could mean that not everything has to be said. It could be you choose when you say things, you think before you talk, mm-hmm. all those kind of things, yeah. right? Not sharing just for the sake of sharing. Which, of course, goes together with the opposite, right? Because when we engage in that kind of life, we don't arouse other people's curiosity and jealousy and so on. But at the same time, and the flip side of that is to build a value of ourselves, to really live in a way where we don't become jealous of other people. Mm-hmm. To work on the midah, to work on the attribute of jealousy, to make sure that it's not there in a negative way. Which is very, very difficult. Why is it difficult? Much more difficult than wearing a red string. Why is it difficult? It's difficult because we're not all wired that way. In other words, and society has taught us that what is outside there defines me, and therefore if I see someone that has what I don't have, I kind of feel less, right? That shouldn't be the case, but that's just the way society runs, right? And it's very difficult to get that place that, no, I'm not less of a person because I don't have what someone else has. Or the idea of great faith, right? I think the Sefer HaChinuch talks about this, that jealousy... And the Torah tells us not to be jealous. It really goes to the heart. It's very interesting. In the Ten Commandments, so we have the first five are between man and God. Belief in God, keeping Shabbat and so on, right? The other five is about between man and man, not to steal, not to kill, right? Yet, there's two that are switched. The one that's for this discussion is, not to be jealous is on the side of how's it going again?
Man.
Yeah, actually, it isn't the side of man and man. Sorry, it's not a man and man, but it's also connected to the concept of the man and God. That's what the conference explains. Why? Because lo tachmod, the idea of not to be jealous, goes against the whole concept of faith and hashkacha pratit. Mm-hmm. And that is that, of course, we need to be successful, of course, we need to work, and of course, we need to achieve in life. But at the end of the day, that's what I'm supposed to do. That's my moral responsibility, to be a functional person and to be as responsible and as effective and successful as I can. But at the end, what I actually get is what I'm supposed to get. And therefore, if I become jealous of what someone else has had, it's not only about being jealous, it's almost about denying that concept that everything comes from God.
Yeah.
Right? Which goes to the heart of the whole concept of gratitude, that we don't take, first of all, we don't take the blessings that we do have for granted, and we celebrate the blessings that we do have, and we understand the blessings that we have come from God, and what I don't have also comes from God. Right? And that's an important thing. So these two values, these two ideas are hatznei lechet, as it's called, to be a modest person as a value, and also not to be a jealous person. They go hand in hand. They're difficult, and they're things that require work every day, and they are, in fact, one of the greatest protections against the concept of ayin hara. Which leads into the third idea. And this is written in many, many places when it discusses this idea of ayin hara. And that is that to protect oneself from ayin hara, we need to become someone who's got an ayin tova, a good eye. Not a bad eye, but a good eye. What's a good eye? A good eye is not only not to be jealous, but it's even more than that. To be happy for someone else's success. Right? So easy to say, and not always so easy to implement. Right? To be really, really happy for someone else who's successful, even successful in something that we don't have. Right? Someone achieved something that maybe we would like to achieve and we didn't, but they did, to be really happy. To be what we call to be mishtatev, to join in their simcha. To make it like your simcha, to make their pain your pain, to make their happiness your happiness. Right? That's an amazing midah, it's an amazing value. To be really happy for someone. You know, when you get invited to a simcha, to really be happy to go, not to because there's something going to be good on the menu, but actually to really enjoy it. And not to see it as a load. Another simcha. Oh my gosh. Right? That's an amazing, that's ayin tova. To really, I mean, it's also ayin tova also means to be generous and to give to other people. That's another part of ayin tova. But on a deeper level, on an emotional level, it means to look at other people good and to be really happy for their successes. That's sometimes needs work. And that's an important thing. And that's, again, is one of the deeper, maybe harder, but deeper protections against the concept of ayin hara. Just before we go on to two more things, just to just take a note on jealousy once again. There's good jealousy also. We've talked about this, but I just want to mention it because we're talking about jealousy. Jealousy is one of the things that God created for a purpose, right? And there's something we call good jealousy, and it's aspiration. We are taught, particularly when someone is successful in... There are two things that define good jealousy. Good jealousy means that it's normally got to do not so much with something material, but with something more of deeper value or spirituality or something like that. Like, or if a person's a good person, you know, I wish I could be like that, right? I wish... And also, it's about not about the other person. You see, bad jealousy normally, and this is why it's so dangerous, spiritually and perhaps even physically, is because bad jealousy normally means not only I want to have what that person has, I actually don't want them to have it. I want to have it only. I want to be better than the other person, right? Good jealousy means I would love to aspire to be the way that person is, but not that that person should lose anything. I want to learn from them, right? There's a great sentence in the Talmud, "Kinat sofrim tarbeh chokhmah." The jealousy among scholars increases wisdom. Because like, you know, when you go into a study hall, you go into a yeshiva, and someone's trying to like, you know, say a good interpretation of the piece of the Talmud or the analysis, and you kind of also want to do that, and you put your point of view, that's good. That increases wisdom. As long as you don't put the other person down. When you're putting the other person down, that's bad jealousy, right? It's like the story in the Chumash when everyone, what's the whole story, the background story to Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach, which was when everyone was able to bring the Pesach sacrifice, and there were a few people that couldn't because they were impure. And they came to Moses and says, why should we jealous? Why should we lose out on that opportunity? And that was considered very good jealousy for that reason. First of all, they were after something spiritual. It wasn't a material success. And second of all, they weren't saying they shouldn't be able to. We also want to have that opportunity. And that's good jealousy. That's okay. That's part of ambition. That's part of what breeds healthy ambition. Okay. So those three things, first of all, which are really all around the same thing. It's about living, being happy, living from inside out, being happy with what we are, defining ourselves by our values, by our blessings, not by what happens on the outside, not by the image we create, but being who we are with our values and our sense of connection with God and so on. Not being jealous of other people, and also being an ayin tova, a good eye towards other people, celebrating other people's success. Then we come to a very, very common Jewish practice, which is we'll get to positive thinking at the end, but a very important Jewish practice, which is very legitimate, and this is done. People do this, right? And that's to say the phrase, bli ayin hara, right? So you do need to share something, or someone asks you a question that you're sharing something that is a blessing that you have, you say bli ayin hara, or in Yiddish, kenen hara, yeah? Now, why is that? Sephardim, they have a different phrase. They say ben parat Yosef, which is a phrase from the Chumash talking about Yosef, Joseph, because we are told that Joseph was given a special blessing to be protected from ayin hara. In fact, there's a story in the Talmud where Rabbi Yochanan, there was a great Rabbi Yochanan, he did something that sort of kind of accentuated or that sort of emphasized the particular blessing that he had. And someone asked him, aren't you worried about ayin hara? And he said, I come from the descendants of Yosef, so I'm okay. Right? He didn't mean it in a flaunting sense. He just meant that, you know, I have a special blessing. But so that's why Sfaradim said, Ben Parachi said. But what's the idea of saying something? How that's going to change things? So here the highlights another very important lesson that we've talked about before. The power of speech. Right? The power of speech is amazing. Not just a phrase. We actually really believe that it makes a difference. Right? That when you do, obviously it comes together with that refined lifestyle, that modest lifestyle and so on. But and not flaunting and all that. But when we do have to do it, or we do have to share something that accentuates or highlights a blessing, we say those words bli ayin hara, and it actually has an effect. Now, we also need to learn the reverse, right? So the reverse is that since speech is so powerful, and we know that, that's Kabbalistically, we know that idea that words, not just the content of the words, but saying the words themselves have such an amazing, powerful impact, that we learn that if that's true in the positive, it's also true, unfortunately, in the negative, right? If we say something bad about someone, it harms someone. And we know that the Talmud tells us, for example, when you gossip about someone or you say something bad about someone, it actually brings out negativity. Even if the person isn't even there, it's not like the person got offended or something, maybe they don't even know about it that you said something, right? Talmud says if you say something negative about a person, the person is affected even if they don't even hear what you're saying. And even if it doesn't, even if not something that's going to ruin their reputation, even if there's just something negative about them, it highlights.
Lashon hara.
It's like lashon hara, but yeah, but I say even lashon hara, if it doesn't affect it, sometimes lashon hara affects a person negatively, just logically. You say something bad about a person, and then they lose their job or they don't get a job, whatever the case is, right? That's a practical negative impact. But even if it doesn't happen, even if they don't even know that you said lashon hara about them, I'm talking about, you know, unacceptable lashon hara, then it still affects them because words have an amazing power. And therefore, because of that, developed the custom that when we do need to say something that could, in theory, be susceptible to the concept of ayin hara, we say bli ayin hara or kanan hara, whatever phrase we choose to use. So that's another interesting thing. Another thing which I want to mention before we get to the final point is that, and I'm you know, because I had this discussion with someone recently about the red string, and they asked me about the red string is good, bad, and I shared with them this idea that, you know, there are sources are legitimate, but I said if you're looking for something tangible and an action to protect yourself, there's some mitzvot, before we get to the wrong string, there are mitzvot which are designed specifically for protection. Mezuzah, for example, having a kosher mezuzah, right? So if anyone's worried about ayin hara, have your mezuzahs checked, right? Mezuzah, we know, is a protection. We spoke about this a few weeks ago. If one wants to upgrade the protection, you know, everyone is upgrading things these days, every so often we upgrade systems. Want to upgrade the protection, you upgrade not just to one door, but to another door, because really mezuzah should be on all the doors, right? So increase a door, increase some doors, increase all the doors, whatever the case is, make sure it's kosher, of course. But that's a real protection. The other thing that the Talmud is full of in terms of protection is not only against ayin hara, but against lots of different things, is giving tzedakah, charity, right? So I would mention this idea, some people have a very, very particular of having, and one should do, having in the home, besides giving charity on a big scale and so on, but there's also the concept of having a pushka, a tzedakah box in a home. Very, very important. It brings blessing to the home. And every so often putting a coin into the tzedakah box, and you know, when it's full, you give it to a tzedakah cause. But that concept, that action of giving tzedakah, it's an action of giving always brings blessing. There are certain times that are very sort of special and significant about giving tzedakah, particularly, for example, before one lights the Shabbos candles on a Friday evening on time, of course, to give a few coins before the lighting, of course, put a few coins in the tzedakah box. This is also another thing that is a real mitzvah that protects. So, as I said, you know, the segulas are very good things. If you want to put a chamsa, no problem. You want to wear a red string, go for it. But I suggest put up a mezuzah, put up another mezuzah, but have a tzedakah box in your house. These are real things. These are real, legitimate, you know, things. The final point I want to make after all this is the following. And this is something, a phrase that comes from the Talmud with regard to lots of these things. And that is the power of positive thinking. There's another phrase, there's another concept in the Torah, in the Talmud, which is discussed, which maybe you wouldn't even know about it, and don't worry about it if you didn't know about it. And even now that you're going to find out about it, don't worry about it. I'll tell you why. Because the Talmud says not to worry about it, right? But there were people, and there still are people, that will not eat things in even numbers. You know, like, so for example, they won't eat, right, you've got to eat three, at least. So they won't have two pieces of gefilte fish, they'll have like either one or three, right? This is not such a good thing for dieting, by the way. Because the Talmud, you know where this comes? There's a whole discussion in the Talmud about the four cups of wine. And how come the rabbis made four cups of wine if it's in even numbers? And the answer is because it's a mitzvah, so it doesn't matter. But there's a whole discussion in the Talmud for a few pages that goes on about this whole thing of what we call zugot, which is doing things in even numbers, right? And at the end of the whole discussion, the Talmud says the following expression, which the commentators apply to ayin hara as well and to lots of other things. And that is, I'll say it in Aramaic and I'll translate it, man de kapdin alei, man de lo kapid lo kapdin alei, which means, he who worries about it has what to worry about, he who doesn't worry about it has nothing to worry about. Right? So, it's an interesting thing with ayin hara, because we do, ayin hara is a real thing, and we do have halachot, as I said before, about not calling up two brothers at the same time, and all that kind of stuff. We do have halachot that, to ward, not to protect ourselves from ayin hara, or not to create ayin hara. We do have, strongly in these things, what I said before, not discounted the idea of living in a sort of refined way, and not flaunting, and not being jealous. That is all true, and with halacha, not standing on other people's, not nosing, putting your nose in other people's business, because that could bring an ayin hara. But at the end of the day, it's not something you should be constantly thinking about, right? This is a debate that went on between my father and my mother all my life. I remember this. So my mother came from the same town as my great-grandfather. They were always worried about Ayin Hara, that I got salt put in my pocket, my bar mitzvah, I said last week, and don't ask, right? And my father would always laugh. He came from a family, and he'd always, whatever my mother would say, oh, it's Ayin Hara, my father would say this phrase from the Talmud. He who worries has what to worry about. He doesn't worry. Right? And she became better at it after a while. But it's not just a phrase. It highlights what we know already to be the truth, which is the power of positive thinking, right? Trust in Hashem. Don't worry about it. If you are worried about it, you know, there's a thing also written about bad dreams, right? What do people do with bad dreams? So there's a whole section of the Talmud about bad dreams, and that dreams could have an effect. And nowadays, there's a letter of the Lubavitcher Rebbe that talks about bad dreams also, and he says, first of all, nothing to worry about. Now that it's only talking about times when people were more focused and when they dreamt things, it actually has significance. Nowadays, just our head is so distracted, we just dream things because that's what we thought about during the day. Mm-hmm. And so it's just the nonsense we think about during the day, so we end up dreaming at night. But so it really has no significance anyway. And he says, if you really worry about it, then put a couple of coins in the pushka, and then just stop thinking about it. Just don't worry about it. Because that itself brings blessing. We just trust in Hashem, I'm saying, in your hands, you protect me, you take care of me. I'm not thinking about it, I'm not engaging in negative thinking. And if we do engage in negative thinking, the only way to get rid of it is to engage in something positive, to think about something good. That positive thinking and not thinking about it, not obsessing about it, is actually the greatest protection. So yes, we should, those who want to do zgulat, like strings and stuff, no problem. Better is the mitzvot and working in our own character to be less jealous and to be more refined and to celebrate other people's success, to engage in mitzvot like mezuzah and tzedakah, and mostly, of course, say bli anara, but not with obsession, just say it because we say it, and mostly to be positive and think positively, and that brings the biggest blessing. Just a quick reminder again. Next week we're taking a break of the topic. It's on the other side of your thing. We're doing a panel discussion on emotional well-being and mental health with Rabbi Benji and Renata, and myself and Levi. Have a wonderful day.